This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. And thanks for joining us in the week when the country came to a standstill as the second Elizabethan era was laid to rest. And the EFL season showed every indication that its quarterway point is looming with a sharp upturn in managerial departures. We'll reflect on all of those and more with Mr. Football League himself.
This is a story of perseverance, persistence, never giving up. Never letting anybody tell you what your ceiling is or should be.
And we'll be joined by one of the EFL's brightest young managers.
If you're not ready to put in them hours, I've played with players throughout my career who've just said Colton's not for them because the time it takes.
It's the official EFL podcast. Yes, the EFL's poster boy himself is with us this week. More than 750 appearances for 8 clubs in all 4 tiers of English football's pyramid, captaining Reading and Leyton Orient to promotions along the way since he hung his boots up. Joby McEnough has become the Sky Bet Championship League One and League Two's go-to authority. And I was looking around your socials and it's quite large letters, A license holder. I'll tell you what I was thinking, Joby. This new life of yours is working out remarkably well, or so it seems on the surface. But have you ever, at any point over the last year and a bit, have you ever thought, do you know what? I wish I'd stuck at coaching. I wish I was taking on my first or second managerial job and getting fired after 15 games and all that stuff. Or are you glad to be out of it?
Well, after seeing a number of managerial departures very, very recently in jobs that are really, really tough. And I think that's the important point you make, Clem. I think certainly League One, League Two, and I found it during my time for sure, they're hard jobs. You know, I certainly feel the threshold for success is quite high at times, whether that's a club deemed to be not performing well enough lower down the league and they should be at least mid-table or up towards playoffs, or those teams that are supposedly guaranteed to be up and around the playoffs all season and might be mid-table and that isn't deemed good enough either. So listen, it's very challenging, I've got to be honest. There of course are times where I look at clubs, managers and think, oh, you know, I wouldn't mind getting back involved with that. But what I will say is certainly yourselves and everybody else is keeping me busy enough that the twitchiness is not getting the best of me yet. And I'm certainly enjoying this side of things for sure.
You're doing brilliantly and I'm absolutely loving watching you. Tell me, I want to ask you a question. Joby, you couldn't help but be moved by what we saw earlier this week. What a send-off for Her Majesty.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. I think from start to finish, it feels like there has been a big build-up to it. Again, with all the nonsense really about whether games should or shouldn't have been cancelled. But once that decision was made and then looking forward in terms of time-wise to the funeral, it was just, I thought, flawless from start to finish. I think, you know, the pageantry, you know, the tradition, everything that we associate, I suppose, with Britishness was there and present. But there was also a nice personal feel to it as well, I think, with the family's involvement and coming together. And again, I put something out on my socials about the pallbearers, the lads who had that unenviable task. I mean, I was kind of on edge at times, you know, going up those stairs in Windsor towards the end. I was just like, and that was after a really long day. And that also struck me the length of it for everybody involved and, you know, just how much energy went into it from everybody's point of view and making sure that it was as special as it was. And certainly, you know, a real fitting tribute and farewell to what was an unbelievable monarch and fantastic lady.
Yeah. And just to continue that tribute to the pallbearers, I think we all thought they'd finally done their brilliant duty when they placed the Queen down in Windsor for the second service. But then it's come out subsequently that they were the ones that actually helped with the family service to place her in the vault and reposition the Duke of Edinburgh, who'd been waiting for his wife to come. I mean, talk about teamwork. Those guys, just extraordinary what they did.
Yeah, incredible. And again, listen, I suppose it's difficult to single out one group of people, you know, when certainly there were so many that did such a great job in making sure that absolutely every part of that service went absolutely to plan, which clearly it did. I just felt it was an amazing celebration, which I think after the sadness, of course, of losing somebody so special to the country, you do have to sort of, I suppose, take a little step back and celebrate the life, you know, how wonderful she was and how many people she connected with around the world. And again, I think that's another key thing for me, you know, the son of a Jamaican immigrant, you know, in terms of, you know, Britain's, I suppose, reign over the Commonwealth and clearly Jamaica being a part of that in years gone by. And I think, again, I think that's the big part of it, how many lives she touched around the world, not just in Britain.
Joby, I suppose the big football headline we should start with this week is Ivan Toney making the England squad. I mean, it's 10 years since his first professional contract at Northampton Town. Ill-fated spell at Newcastle didn't quite work out. Two loan spells at Barnsley, one at Shrewsbury, two loan spells at Scunthorpe. Then another one at Wigan Athletic before finding his feet at Peterborough United. I mean...
Love it.
I do. Love it. I absolutely adore it. I just love those stories where it was a bit like with Ricky Lambert a few years ago as well, wasn't it? When he came off the bench and scored with his first touch on his debut. And I think I probably leapt out of my seat more when Ricky did that, having been with him through some of those stages and journeys. Ivan is just wonderful. I truly hope he makes the World Cup in November.
I do too. And listen, if he does, it'll be based on performance levels and what he's doing at Brentford. He's been absolutely phenomenal. But again, going back to his journey, his story, and the reason I love it, you know, you'll see lads up and down academies that have got the ability to go and play professionally for a living and potentially maybe go and play in the Premier League. But this is a story of perseverance, persistence, never giving up, never letting anybody tell you what your ceiling is or should be. And certainly for me, it's a great lesson, not just again in our world in terms of the football industry, but for anybody out there that you can achieve absolutely anything you want. If you're disciplined, you put your mind to it and you really go out and do it with a smile on your face as well, which I think when you watch Ivan Toney playing and certainly his social media accounts, he's not one to back away from the odd bit of fun, we'll say. Again, he's had it with Arsenal over the last week or so. So, great stuff. Really pleased to see for him.
Yeah, and I tell you what, if nothing else, even if he was on the bench, because you know what we're like at penalties in big tournaments. I mean, you'd want to be able to bring him on, even if he hadn't featured in the game, you'd like to be able to bring him on with 2 minutes to go to, would you dare take a penalty like that in a World Cup semi-final? Let's nip into the Sky Bet Championship. And do you know what, Joby, because you're coming on, I'm not overly prepared too much. I mean, obviously, I would like to dig into Danny Schofield's departure from Huddersfield. One win in eight, six defeats for Danny has seen him get on his way. They subsequently won at the weekend at Cardiff, and that cost Steve Morrison his job. Three league wins in 10 so far for them. Should we start there with those two? I mean... Is sacking the manager becoming too easy? Are they becoming the obvious fall guy?
Absolutely. And it comes back to your earlier point about whether I want to get back involved in it all. And probably these are two examples of probably why I don't at this moment in time. Because when you look at, again, the job description, I think everybody's going off of what Carlos Corberan did last year, certainly in Huddersfield's case. The late departure of him, you know, Danny Schofield having to go in there really unexpectedly with a team that very, very much overachieved last year, Clem. And I think for them to have got anywhere near the playoffs this year, even with Carlos Corberan, you know, would have been tough going. I've been around a few Huddersfield games. I've got to be honest, I don't think he ever really looked super comfortable as the main guy. And I think stepping up from a coach to a manager is a real tough transition, particularly when it is thrown on you, as it has been in his case.
Yeah, well, it's something I'm going to be discussing with Stephen Schumacher a little bit later on this week's episode of the official EFL podcast. Steve Morrison, I mean, 17 new players in the summer. I mean, I don't know. We just seem to be out of the frying pan into the fire, don't we? We just, you know, we trust a guy enough to be involved in the recruitment of nearly an entirely new squad. And then... after 10 games, we say, actually, we've changed our minds.
Well, that is the big factor for me when I look at Cardiff City and Steve Morrison. I mean, you're talking about the other day in the last match, 9 of those starting 11 were new signings. And that says it all for me. It takes time for players to gel, for the manager to get his ideas across. Listen, goal scoring has been an issue, certainly, for Cardiff. But again, for me, when you've that bigger turnover, I don't know what you're really supposed to do. I mean, the club's angle will be that they've backed him in the market and they were expecting better results, I'm sure, than they've got so far. But there is a process to these things. And unfortunately, no managers are really afforded the time to really implement that style and that philosophy anymore. It is very much a, you know, you have to win games almost instantly. Otherwise, you're judged as a failure, which is clearly what's happened there. And I've got a lot of sympathy for Steve Morrison, I've got to be honest.
Yeah. Pleasant surprises this season. I'm going to say big disappointments. And that obviously means there's going to be a conversation about Middlesbrough coming up. But listen, Sheffield United, first of all, already 5 points clear of those playoff places and starting to become quite machine-like. Must mention Reading along the way, mustn't we? Because they're definitely surprised a lot of people. I'll tell you another line I picked out at the weekend. Blackburn's game was their 600th successive match with an academy graduate in their match day squad. It's a run that goes all the way back to Sam Allardyce. Now, listen, that might seem like the most obvious thing with the time and energy and investment that goes into academies, but it's not a shoo-in anymore, is it?
No, not at all. And a lot of that comes back down to the pressure that managers are on and needing instant results. And I think sometimes when you've got a kid who's come from the academy and you're not quite sure what you're going to get, you know, there can be a tendency to go with that experience. But, you know, fantastic from their point of view that they've kept that run going. I think if you scoop through the leagues, I'd have to certainly say, you know, Reading have, I'd say, overachieved in terms of where I think we all thought, not just me as a former player of the football club and someone who still very much keeps a track of what's going on there, that they would struggle this season. I think Paul Ince has done a fantastic job. A lot of that is just based on pure hard work, I've got to be honest, from what I've seen, and making sure they respond well, which they have done on 3 occasions from really bad results. They've come back and won games. You know, Sheffield United is an interesting one for me. Norwich is an interesting one because they've kept faith with managers. You know, and listen, Paul Heckenbottom did a brilliant job. I'm not saying his job was ever in doubt, but they have that continuity from last season. And again, Norwich is slightly different in the fact that they weren't performing very well, but they know what the manager wants. They're back at this level. And that's only going to help that squad or those squads in terms of what the real aim is getting themselves up the table. So, you know, both clubs from their point of view and Reading have had a fantastic start to this season.
Even so early in with their track record, despite all was said, Rob Edwards, Watford, yet to win an away game, drawing a lot, you know, not taking the 3 points instead of one. And you start to look at them as well a little bit, don't you?
In his case is with his appointment, you know, being the young British coach, fairly inexperienced, that the club would give him time. You know, whether that is the case at Watford, there's clearly something they don't usually do. I'm not sure. There has been a little bit of rumbling around the club in terms of probably style. They've never really controlled games so far this season. They are looking like they're relying a little bit on that front. Well, we would say three, but obviously Emmanuel Dennis, Keenan Davis has come in, who I think is going to be a fantastic addition. I do think he will get it right. I do think they've got enough quality to certainly be in the mix for playoffs. I think top two might be a bit of a stretch, but I would certainly like to see Watford stick with him and give him a chance to really mould a team in his style.
I think it's going to come right for Steve Bruce at West Brom. Do you think it's going to come right for Chris Wilder at Middlesbrough?
I'm going to say yes to both of those, Clem. I've got to be honest. I think you look at West Brom, you like a little stat or two, don't you, Clem?
What you got? Come on, let me have it.
No, just a quite straightforward one. The top of the XG table in terms of chances created and expected goals in terms of quality of chances, and also, I say bottom, but in a good way, of the XG against. So if you're looking at those performance factors, which again, as a coach, you sometimes have to fall back on those. They have actually played really well. Did their Watford game, you know, Burnley, they should have beaten them. Even the game Norwich, they're performing generally well, but they need to stick the ball in the back of net a little bit more than they have done. And Middlesbrough is a bit of a conundrum to me. You know, he has been backed in the market, Chris Wilder, very vocal about wanting reinforcements across the whole summer, even right up to the window. They were given to him, and certainly they are nowhere near where they need to be. I mean, the one caveat I will give is that that table is so tight, and two or four, three wins, you know, the whole picture changes. And I would certainly, again, expect him very, very soon to turn things around at Middlesbrough.
That was the sort of answer that I was hoping for. Thank you very much. Skybet League One. Obviously, no fixtures in Skybet Championship this coming weekend. Skybet League One. Still has two unbeaten teams at the top of the table, living up to the promise of being big clubs in this division, as obviously Sheffield Wednesday and Bolton tucked into those playoff places. Derby just outside our as well.
Yeah, again, you know, massive credit to Kieran McKenna at Ipswich. It's all well and good saying that a team is going to be a favourite, but particularly when you're one of those big teams, and they have struggled a little bit with that expectation. But certainly this year have found a cutting edge to add to what was already a very meticulous, you know, ball possession type of formation and philosophy that he built there. And he's really gone and added that. I think Portsmouth, again, great start to the season for them. It's exciting for me on a look across League One. You know, Plymouth, probably the ones that have come out of the pack a little bit, that maybe, again, that level of expectation isn't there, which I think they can really use in their favour. And of course, Sheffield Wednesday. So I think the teams that we expected to be there are. That isn't always the case. So big credit to those guys for dealing, I suppose, with that expectation. Michael Smith coming on for Sheffield Wednesday, getting a last minute equaliser will be big, and obviously him getting fit and being able to contribute, I'm sure will help Darren Moore's cause for Sheffield Wednesday trying to get in that top two.
Yeah, and at the bottom of the table, first wins of the season for Morecambe and for Burton. Burton having changed their manager with Dino Marmria taking over. Morecambe obviously sticking with Derek Adams there. Your fixtures this coming weekend. Saturday, Barnsley are currently sixth at home to Charlton. And there's a couple of top six games on Saturday. It is second place Portsmouth against fifth place Bolton. Sheffield Wednesday in fourth entertain Wickham. And then on Sunday, it is third v the leaders Ipswich as Plymouth Argyle entertain them. We will hear from Stephen Schumacher a little bit later on. Into Skybet League Two and more managerial changes. And I feel a bit for Paul Hartley at Hartlepool United, because he came with a good reputation, 5 promotions in 11 seasons up in Scotland. You could see what the appointment was all about. But to go back to your earlier point, you need to put a bit of sugar in the bowl occasionally, even if you're laying down a base for later in the season or for a future season. I think any manager knows you've got to win at least 1 in 3 in order to earn the right to do that. We should say as well that Hartlepool are on the longest active winless streak across the entire EFL of 18 matches. So he may have inherited a culture that was difficult to turn around.
Yeah, and listen, that is part of the job. He would have known what he was going into. But again, the point about adding sugar to the bowl, I mean, for everybody's sake, whether that's the players, to believe in what you're asking them to do, ultimately they are driven by winning games of football. And if you're not getting what everybody wants, which is that win on a Saturday or a Tuesday night, then maybe some questions start creeping in. The same with fans, you know, and it's all well and good saying you've got a way of doing things and you want to get to, you know, this point in time where you're playing a certain type of football or this performance will get results, but you have to win games to get there. And certainly if you don't win in the first 9, yes, it's come off the back of a poor winless run off the back of last year. But then going on to Dino Marmaria previously, he goes into a team that hadn't won a game, conceding for fun, you know, clean sheet straight away. And he puts his imprint on what he wants his team to look like. And I think that is, for me, the big bit of management. It's finding a way with those players to get a result. And clearly, unfortunately for Paul Hartley, hasn't been able to do that at Hartlepool.
But then again, you do wonder about the remit given, because I've always felt that if you're a good manager, surely your job is to go and utilise what you've got, not go, right, I'll have it right in a year and a half's time when you've brought me in all the players that you want. But I suppose it depends on what you've agreed with your board, doesn't it? I'll tell you what I do feel sorry for. I feel sorry for Wayne Brown at Colchester United. They are looking for their 7th manager in 8 years. I was reading an article, interestingly, and just reminding us that they've all been internal appointments. Joe Dunn, Tony Humes, John McCreary, Steve Ball, and Hayden Mullins, I think, was assistant first before stepping. Were you two? Where were you two together? Hey, you and Hayden, were you together at Watford? No?
It was actually at West Ham and Reading with Hayden.
Yeah, and Reading. All right. But yeah. you were together with him at any club other than the one I thought you were together with him at. And then we got this merry-go-round going at Colchester because they've given the job, temporarily at least, back to Steve Ball, who was sacked in February of last year, having gone 13 games without a win. And you know what I hear about this as well is when club legends put their reputation on the line.
Yeah.
And he obviously saved them at the end of last season, 8 league wins in 13, but 1 in 9 this time around, and Wayne Brown's on its way.
Yeah, again, another manager, and we seem to be coming back to the same thing about feeling sorry for him. And I do at this stage of the season. And again, you have to look at, in terms of resources, and we've seen with Colchester in terms of certainly cutting back, you know, whether it be budget-wise, you know, having to let key players leave at certain points. And it isn't just for Wayne Brown. This is previous managers. I had a good chat with Hayden Mullins after the time he spent there, and we discussed some of the issues, I suppose, and challenges, again, you know, at managing at clubs where, listen, you're not quite getting maybe the backing that you feel you need to go out and get those results. And I certainly feel that is a tough job. You only have to see the trajectory of the club. I think they have to be really, really careful the way that the owner is going around about his business and some of the appointments. Maybe you've spoke about all the internal appointments, an external and an outward looking philosophy, maybe someone to come in with a fresh set of ideas and principles, a little bit different to what they've had. Because at the moment, you know, and certainly the last few years in particular, they're on a bit of a downward spiral.
I wonder whether you almost incorporate a managerial change as part of the mechanisms of your club. Because some clubs do get in this habit. We'll make a change in November after a poor start. We'll have a flush. We might get two or three wins. And those 6-7 points might be the difference at the end of the season that keeps us up. And then when that fella then the next summer tries to lay a base to go forward and he has a poor start, we'll just do the same to him.
Well, again, a club like Colchester, we talk about remits. I mean, what would you think the remit would be there, given the fact that their budget is very small for the level? You know, they have had to let players go. So at the moment, he's keeping them out of the relegation zone. I mean, clearly, you know, that's not good enough for where they think they should be. But where does that come from? You know, it's got to be based on something in terms of that expectation or that pressure to be doing better than they are at the moment. And that's where I think it's quite unrealistic for someone like a Wayne Brown, unfortunately, for him to work wonders and work miracles sometimes.
A Colchester fan came up to me and wanted to talk about it. And I said exactly what we've just been talking about. I feel really sorry for him. It was terrible football we were playing, said the fan. And I thought, well, you know, what do you want? Do you want to play a lovely, glossy football and go down? Or are you prepared to hold the line but stay in the league? Again, it comes down to priorities, Joby. There's a couple of things I spotted. Of the two promoted teams, Grimsby doing far better than the overwhelming favourites who are supposedly ready to wump straight through the league, Stockport. I don't know whether we can read in anything into that. Stockport dropped a lot of points so far this season for a team that had apparently been preparing for this campaign before they'd come out of the National League last year.
Yeah, again, I've got to be honest, I was a little bit miffed, and this is the greatest respect to everybody at Stockport County about how well priced up they were at the start of the season and automatically thrust into that sort of favourite spot, you know, in League Two. It's a tough transition at times. And I think sometimes you need that little bit of a period to just really get to grips with the league. Yes, we have seen some teams come up and bounce straight up, but, you know, it is a bit of a step up and I think it will just take a little bit of time. So maybe for me, just a bit over fancied at the start of this season, which then leads to the impression they're probably not doing as well as other people maybe thought they should be doing. And again, they are well backed financially, but that doesn't equate to results on the pitch all the time.
But I tell you what, Grimsby's success does equate to. Paul Hurst obviously had a bit of a sticky time when he chanced his harm and took the Ipswich job, and he's regrouped and he had a difficult time. He couldn't stop Grimsby going out of the league, but he brought them back via the playoffs. And now look at them sitting in that cluster just outside the top seven.
Yeah, and listen, again, for me, I just feel that sometimes in journeys, in whether it's players, management, they're just good fits. And certainly for me, Paul Hurst and Grimsby seems like that at the moment. That's not to say that he won't, one, do really well with Grimsby and potentially take them to where they want to get to. But, you know, later on down the line, again, get that other opportunity that he had previously where it just didn't quite work out. And, you know, he's doing, a great job there. And they've had a really good start to the season. And I suppose showing that you can come up and be super competitive, you know, if everything's right in terms of the coaching, management and off the pitch, there's no reason why you can't come up and have a really good season.
Richie Welland's looking like a good fit for Leighton Orient. He doesn't like the rents in the sort of area that you live in. I know that for certain because he's got himself a flat down there with the family still being in the northwest. He's a northerner still getting used to southern prices, he keeps telling me. But I tell you what, he's absolutely flying, isn't he?
Yeah, brilliant start. Well, I say start to this season, but of course he had a period where, you know, he could come in and get his feet under the table. Again, a manager who we came across when I was actually at Orient, we played against his Swindon team, who were absolutely fantastic. You know, they keep the ball so well, clearly in terms of goals against, the lowest conceded in the league only for this season, and their home form in particular, well, their form in general has been amazing, but 5 wins out of 5 and have kept 4 clean sheets in that. So for a team that, and a manager that is looked at as a real good offensive manager and real good possession team, it's that defensive side of things really. But a lot of that comes from keeping the ball as well as they do. And I've said it for a few years now, I've got to be honest, everything is in place at that football club to get out of League Two. They've had a good look at it. You know, for me, you know, with everything behind the scenes and the way the football club's run, absolutely, that should be a team at the top end of League Two at worst, looking to get up into League One.
In fact, the top two go head to head this coming weekend because Barrow are currently second, Entertain Leighton Orient, third place Northampton Town are at home to Stockport in an earlier kickoff, 2 o'clock in that one. Bradford, who have snuck into the playoff places under Mark Hughes, currently fifth, they entertain Wimbledon. Mansfield in seventh, head to Crewe. It is Stevenage in fourth at home to Harrogate, and Salford in sixth at Sutton United. I had to tell you, I had a lovely time going to spend the morning with Richie and Matt Harold and everybody down there at Leighton Orient a few weeks ago for Football Focus. Mate, hilarious. You'll know what it's like there. The training ground is shared with a school, is it? With a school. The youth team coach went home with the key for the ship's container that had all the gear in. He couldn't be located, so the handyman from the school had to come and try and break into the container. Joby, he brought, first of all, obviously, tried with a hammer, first of all, that didn't work. He then came back with a sledgehammer. Nope, that padlock was not going to be smashed off that container. A hacksaw. At this point, I had concerns that he might cut his fingers off because he couldn't seem to get that initial purchase and make the breakthrough with the saw edges into the metal. We did find a resolution. My suggestion, we dig a tunnel from outside and come through the floor, was not accepted. But he did eventually manage to find an angle grinder where he managed to angle grind the padlock off. Although he had done damage to the padlock holder, the sort of bracket, which made his life even harder with the angle grinder. Life in League Two, eh, Joby? Which you obviously don't miss certain aspects of.
No, and I can certainly sympathise with that story at Old Chigwellian's, it is, at the Leighton Orient training ground. And listen, it's a great, funny story, but it does show some of the demands and challenges that you face in lower league management. Everyone sees that performance on a Saturday or a Tuesday, but there are loads you've got to deal with. I mean, that place in particular, we've turned up at times and, you know, it's been snowing or really cold and there's nowhere to train. They've recently built a 4G pitch, which has been a massive help actually to do with the school over there. But yeah, there are things that come up that you have to deal with. I think that's more to do with a lack of communication and someone a little bit eager to get off for the day rather than anything else. And I wouldn't have fancied going under the ground because in the summer, that is like absolute rock solid. I've done many a back injury and knee injury at that training ground, Clem. So I don't think you would have much luck going underneath.
You see, I said right at the start, you were the soothsayer of the EFL. You were the man of great knowledge. Nobody else could have given me that information. I just felt wounded that I'd tried to make a contribution to getting the gear out and I'd just been completely ignored. You've explained why. Joby, sincerely, I am loving how your media career is developing. So unless you really want to go back to coaching and management, just keep doing what you're doing because it's a joy watching you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Clem. I think this pod's just put an end to that for now, by the way. So no chance of that. I'll be joining you again soon, mate. Don't worry.
This is the official EFL podcast.
Let's finish off this week by dipping into Sky Bet League One, where, as we mentioned earlier, Plymouth Argyle currently sit third ahead of this weekend's visit from leaders Ipswich Town. It is 19 league wins in his 35 games in charge since succeeding Ryan Lowe last December for manager Stephen Schumacher. And do you know what? I've always wanted to ask you, and all the time I was watching you as a player and stuff and never got round to, what's the origins of your surname? I mean, clearly Shoemaker, but what's your heritage, mate?
Everybody asks me that, you know, and it's probably something I need to look into. It's obviously got German origins, the name, from way back when, but we've never ever traced it. I think my auntie tried one time a few years ago, but I don't know how successful or how far along she got with it. But everybody always asks me where the name comes from, and I actually don't know. So I'm just Kirby through and through, Clem, yeah.
Do you know what? I've got a good idea of what to buy you for Christmas. I'm going to get you one of those Ancestry.com DNA kits. They're about 70 quid. You spit in a tube, send it off, and it comes back with all the breakdown of your DNA. And so that's got to be worth doing, hasn't it?
It's got to be, yeah, with an unusual surname. Then there must be something that to look into that might be interesting. So, yeah, we'll give that a go, Clem. Stick it on the list.
I think we should. I tell you what, in your early days when you were breaking through at Everton, you could have, especially in the current era where it's so many players are of overseas origin, you could have probably, well, actually, there's a flaw in my plan. Yeah. I was going to say you could have passed yourself off as some swanky up-and-coming German that everybody knows about over there. But of course, then you'd open your mouth and then...
They couldn't figure out, no.
It's not going to work out, is it? Tell me something. In any way, did your experience at Everton, your love as a football club, and not quite making the breakthrough there despite your success at youth level, did that in any way influence the fact you're probably ahead of the game in terms of your qualifications for going forward from your playing career?
Yeah, possibly. I think when I left Everton, Clem, the time, and I think I was like 19, 20 when I left, and I just played for England in a tournament. We played in the Euros, or I think it was over in Austria, and in the pre-season, and then the following off-season was released. So in this day and age, that probably wouldn't happen in England under 20, or it was under 20 or under 19 tournament. That wouldn't happen this day where you'd let somebody go who's been involved in an England squad. But just the way Everton were then as a club, it was David Moyes sort of going to go into his second full season as a manager, and Everton had too many players on the books, and we had to sort of clear the decks, if you like. And I was one of them people that was there that wasn't near the first team at the time. So I had to move on and go and sort of carve a career in. I went to Bradford City at first and obviously took a couple of steps back in League One, and the plan was always to try and get back there and play for Everton. That was my goal. It didn't quite work out. Probably wasn't good enough and physical enough probably to go and play in the Premier League and at the top level. But, you know, I went and played over 450 games in League One and League Two. So got a grounding. And then probably from the age of about 25, 26, I figured out that look, your chances of you getting back to the Premier League is going to be slim. And started to look into the coaching then, started to do little bits. I went back to Everton initially when I was playing for Bury. Dipped in and out with Neil Dewsnip as he was coaching Tom Davis and, you know, John Joe Kenny sort of age group, started helping him out a little bit coaching. And then throughout then, the rest of me playing career always had one eye on it, that I needed to get me qualifications, needed to get me badges. So as soon as I was finished the game, I knew I was going to go into coaching. I knew that was where my passion was. That was what I was really, you know, keen to do. So I went and done it. And yeah, thankfully, I wasn't out of the men's environment for too long. I was only coached back at Everton's academy under 11s for 6 months, and I was back in a first team environment at Bury with Ryan Lowe, and then the rest is history. Yeah,
well, you've missed out as well. You obviously have a thirst for learning because you also did your degree in sports journalism and broadcasting too. Yeah. And so, which, Steve, it takes some doing that to be holding down the sort of playing career you had, plus to be working hard, to try and get your coaching badges and doing the hours necessary to get them in the bag, but at the same time to be doing a completely separate degree as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was a challenge, but again, Clem, growing up in school, I was average intelligence, I would say. I did okay in my GCSEs, but I always knew I was going to be playing for Everton because I'd signed a contract when I was 14, 15, a professional contract. So probably didn't give school as much time as I should have. So then when I was coming towards the end of my playing career, I always had one eye on the back of my mind. Well, I haven't earned enough to go and retire playing in League One, League Two, all my life. So what am I going to do next? I knew it was going to be coaching. And I had one eye on potentially going over to the States because my wife's two sisters both live out in California. So I had one eye at potentially going to coaching, one of the big universities or whatever. So I thought, well, if I've got a university degree as well as my playing background plus my coaching background, it would give me a better chance of getting a decent job. And I decided to take it on. I enjoyed the journalism and broadcasting course. It was really hard work, especially when you're trying to still play as well. But I just felt that it set me up, and even if I didn't use it to go on over to the States or be a coach for the coaching capacity, it would give me some training if I ever became an half-decent coach or a decent manager. So now I'm having to deal with the media a little bit. I've kind of got a little bit of a clue of what to do and what to say.
I love it. And what to prepare for when these questions come along. What do you think the mix of a modern-day manager is? A manager of your era, first sort of 3, 4, 5 years into the game. What do you think's in there these days, needs to be in there?
I think the majority of the young coaches, speaking for myself, you've got to be incredibly hard working and you've got to have a passion for it because it takes up a lot of time. Obviously, your family is the most important thing, but my family and my kids know that I'm always preparing for games or I'm analysing games that we've just watched. So you've got to have a passion about it. You've got to be dedicated to put the hours in.
Hold on, Stephen. Hold on a second. So paint a picture for me. Are the family with you in the Southwest? They are with you? Because that would be a hell of a struggle for you, wouldn't it, if they were up in the Northwest?
Yeah, and that was one of the... when I was playing at Stevenage, Clem, I lived for 12 months without away from... I had two really young... The kids were really young at the time. And I lived for a year away from my missus and the kids, and it was a struggle. And in the second season, we lived together. So we said, wherever we go from now on, we'll just all go as a package because it was too far to commute backwards and forwards to Liverpool in the Northwest. So when we got offered this job down in Plymouth, obviously I knew where it was geographically, and then I knew that it can't commute backwards and forwards, especially with the hours that a number two has got to do and watching the games and stuff. It just wouldn't have worked. And my kids were 5 and 8 at the time, so relocating them from the Northwest down to the Southwest was okay because they went straight into primary schools and within 2 days I had best friends. So they were cool and they got settled in. My wife met friends down here. It's a lovely part of the world, but people are friendly. They're very similar to where we're from up in the Northwest. So she settled in great. And it's a gorgeous part of the world to bring your family up. So really lucky with that it all worked out. And I think it was, made that decision easier then when I was offered the job. Do you want to stay? We were all here. We were all settled, and leaving Ryan was a big decision, but it's one I felt that I was ready for. And as I say, my wife and the kids were happy down here. Didn't feel any rush to get home, and so we went for it.
Yeah, and paint a picture for us at home, because you said you're constantly preparing for a game and stuff. Does that mean you're in the room with them, but sometimes you're not in the room? Dad, can you help me with this bit of homework? Dad, are you going to come and watch Strictly preview or something? Meanwhile, you're sitting down there. Yeah, I will in a second, but I just want to check how this Aki Stanley centre-half is on his left side.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. You are there all the time, but sometimes you're not there. Your brain is elsewhere. And I'm guessing all the other young managers that we've just been speaking about, that's another one of the traits. Like, we can never switch off. Like, I think the older you get, the more experience you get. Like, I speak to Nigel Pearson, I speak to the other managers who've been in and around. They found a way to switch off. But at this moment in time, where I'm still learning and still trying to figure out how to be a head coach and a manager, the game is constantly on my mind. I'm lucky that I've got a young lad. I've got a lad who absolutely loves football. My little boy, Vincent, he's 8. And sometimes he'll come and watch games with me and sit on my knee and watch it while I'm watching the laptop. We watched the game the other day, and within 10 minutes, he said to me, "Dad, this is boring, this game. The ball's always in the air and it's always out of play." He said, "I'm not watching it." So I won't name the team who we watch, but yeah, he gave up after 10 minutes, but I had to slog on through it.
I'll tell you what, there's a lovely story that Robbie Martinez told probably 7 or 8 years ago now, that him and his missus at home have L-shaped sofas and they've got two tellies, and he's got one on one wall with radio headphones, and then Beth's got one on the other wall, I think, and she can watch. So they can sit together, be together, but he's not sitting in a study somewhere and they're not together, but he's also not dictating, better just watch Spanish League 2 just in case there's a player in there that should be on my radar, which I thought was quite a nice way of doing things, you know?
It is nice, but I don't think my wife, Victoria, would put up with that. So I'm quite lucky, Clem. We only live 5 minutes from the stadium, so I can stay and work till whatever hours I need to stay in. I can get all my work done and then come out the office, put my laptop away, come home, do the school run, take the kids to dance class or football training or whatever they've got. And then, yeah, before you know it, it's bedtime and back to the grind again the next day. Great.
All those 400 plus games you played, lots of different managers, lots of different characteristics. Who's been a big influence on you?
What, former managers?
Yeah.
I think I've learned sort of something from all of them. I thought I worked under some real good coaches and some young, inexperienced ones, highly experienced ones. And the first one I remember was Colin Todd when I went to Bradford City. And I hadn't heard from him since I left in like 2007, I think I left Bradford City. And he called me the first week that I got the job and just said he wanted to touch base and say good luck and if you need any advice and any help, he was always there on the end of the phone. So I thought that was nice. He was brilliant. He gave us the confidence as a young boy leaving Everton, sort of down a little bit because David Moyes just released me, sort of gave me the confidence to go and play and played 130 games or whatever for Bradford under him and loved it. So it was nice to hear from him. And then one of the other coaches who I really respected and got on really well was Alan Nil. He had us at Bury. He's now Chris Wilder's number two. So again, when I was a number two, could pick the phone up to Nilly and ask him for advice and help whenever I needed it. But I think good and bad managers who I've worked under throughout my career, I've sort of tried to take something from all of them. I think even subconsciously they help mould to what type of coach you're going to be in the future as well. So yeah, I've enjoyed it. I've been quite lucky, really.
Yeah. Are you and Louis quite similar? Because I had the pleasure of watching a training session just before you took over. I don't know if you remember, I came out for Football Focus, but I think you were in the thick of it. And Ryan that day was a bit more sort of, you know, what managers do sometimes, stand there with their arms folded and just observe the finer nuances of a session. But you do seem to have very similar sunny personalities. Would that be a reasonable interpretation?
Yeah, I think we're both incredibly positive people. So I think, and again, we love what we do. Our styles are different. So Ryan is probably more extrovert than I am. I'm probably a bit more reserved and think about things a little bit more before I speak. And Ryan's very good. He works a lot off instinct. He's brilliant, like just in a room. And when he gets thrown into a situation, he can adapt. But our styles are different on the coaching pitch. I was, as you say, the one who was in the thick of it and going through the detail. That's the type of personality I was. And Ryan could stand there and watch and observe. But then if he had something to say, more often than not, he'd be blob on with what he needed to do. And that little relationship that we had, it worked. It was good. We had a great partnership. And it was for 4.5 years, whatever, we worked together. And we complemented each other. Now, Ryan's gone and got now Mike Marsh, who I know is a real good grass coach and is probably very similar to me, goes through the details. So he's probably continued to do what he's done. And I brought in Mark Hughes as my number two, as my assistant, who isn't quite, I've got the experience yet of being the grass coach and doing the detail every single day. But his observation, he's only just finished playing. He was, we got him from Bristol Rovers and in January, he literally just retired. So him giving information to the players, just dropping in every now and again, there's information that he can give is so valuable. So I think whatever way you have your partnership, it's got to sort of complement each other. And me and Ryan certainly did that, yeah.
Yeah. But have you had to train yourself in certain situations, say on the grass, to stand back? Your instinct is to jump in and get involved, but actually you're having to learn the art of just taking three steps back and counting to 10 before you intervene, because that's more of the overseer's role.
Yeah, I think, listen, I'm still pretty very much hands-on as a coach, especially the game prep and towards the end of the week. That's kind of still been my style, and that's what I enjoy. Clement's what I feel as though I'm quite good at, so I don't want to come away from that. What I have learned, though, is that you can't be everybody's mate. When you're a number one, whereas you can be when you're a number two, you can always sort of give people advice and help, but there's going to be times in the week where players avoid you and don't want to make eye contact with you because they get the sense that you're not going to pick them in the team. And I'm finding that a challenge and figuring out how to deal with that. Whereas Ryan had that experience over me for the last 4 years. He was the one who made the final call, if you like. And I'm sort of trying to learn how to do that and understand that I'm not going to be a flavour of the month for everybody every single week. But as long as I can explain my reasons behind things, and I think the lads are good enough to accept the decisions, yeah.
I mean, that in itself is a life lesson to learn, isn't it? That, you know, you're not going to be popular all the time for the reasons you've just described. I mean, you maybe need a thicker skin, as you say, than being an assistant to be able to cope with that aspect.
Yeah, you do. And I say there's definitely different challenges between the number one and the number two. Some things are very similar. And you, as I say, I'll carry on working the way I always used to work as a number two. But you have to learn different sides of it. I've got to communicate with the CEO now. I've got to communicate with the board. I've got to deal with the press. I've got to then pick up the phone to agents in the transfer windows, and you know, people will be on the phone and stressing you out. Whereas my sole focus for the previous 4 years has been just on the team, but there's so much else around it when you become the manager that you've got to deal with. So it's important then you have got a good backroom team and a backroom staff that you know you can trust to take care of, you know, the nitty gritty, go and make sure that the cones are put out right and make sure that the pitch sizes are right, start the sessions for us. And then when you're there for the bit that you need to be at the end, you should, hopefully you're going to be focused on it. But yeah, it's a little bit more to deal with it as the number one for sure.
At the start of this season, how much were you able to take the positives out of the last campaign? I think I'm right in saying it was the best finish for over a decade.
Yeah.
And not allow the disappointment of the final game, which you went into with hope and obviously didn't work out as planned, to overshadow and be too much of a depressive force.
Yeah, so that was really hard because obviously we missed out and we were so close, and to get 80 points in a League One season, that was just, it was incredibly competitive every single game. For us to play so well and stay in the playoff places for as long as we did, then miss out on the final day on my birthday. And we didn't just miss out, we got whacked.
Mate, I didn't know that. Oh,
it was on my birthday. God. We got whacked 5-0. Scott Twine produced a masterclass and we got whacked. So obviously that was all everyone was talking about and things were labelled against us. But when we looked at the bigger picture, it was an unbelievable season for us to get that many points where we'd finished the season before, 18th in the league. Nobody gave us a hope for even challenging the top six. We had to look at the positives, but also I quickly then moved to, okay, well, what can we learn from it? And we learned that against the top six teams last season, we didn't get enough points. We wasn't prepared and we were probably a bit too easy to play against. Everybody knew our system. We're going to play 3-5-2. That's how they play. If they make substitutions, it's the same system, different personnel. And we were probably a little bit one-dimensional, whereas I felt that this year, if I then go and try and recruit players that could give us different options, try and get more goal scorers in the team from different areas of the pitch, whereas we could adapt and then go and play differently against the tops. If you're not ready to put in them hours, I've played with players throughout my career who've just said coaching's not for them because the time it takes. That was my focus then, probably after a couple of days of that disappointment, right, okay, how do we get better? And worked hard on it over the summer, got some players in, spoke about it to the players, explained what we were going to try and do. how we were going to have different approaches to certain games. And thankfully this season they bought into it and we've got off to a great start. So we just want that to continue.
Yeah. I mean, Ryan quite famously said about this time last year, we're on course to become a sustainable second tier club. Is that still a mantra that runs richly throughout the whole of the structure there?
Yeah, I think that's one of the owner, Simon Hallett. That's one of his visions, to be a sustainable championship club and to be respected in the Southwest and beyond. And I think people can see what we're trying to do at Plymouth Argyle. We're trying to do things the right way. Like, we haven't got a budget, Clem, the same, nowhere near the same as what some of the League One teams in this division have got. So we have to think differently and think, how can we still be competitive when we haven't got the finances yet? I think in a few years' time, we'll be closer to the finances that the big clubs have got. But we're not in a position, and we don't want to take unnecessary risks to just chuck money at it and think it's just going to work, because 10 years ago, this club was in administration. So the owner won't allow that to happen now. So we've got to build slowly financially. But in the meantime, try and think outside the box, try and use data analytics as much as we can, try and use as much information and get our recruitment right so we can go and compete against the odds, against these big teams in the division. And we did it last year. Everyone thought it might have been a flash in the pan, but this year we've competed so far, and that'll be the goal. Let's try and go one step further.
I'm going to ask you a really tough question to finish. You seem remarkably comfortable in your own skin. What do you worry about? See, you're having to think about this one, aren't you?
Yeah, I think I just want to do the best job as possible. What I worry about is that people get frustrated if we don't achieve what we want to achieve immediately. So as long as people can see that we're trying to do things the right way, we're trying to build. We're not going to build overnight and become a championship team, you know, tomorrow. That's not where we're at. I haven't got them facilities or finances, as I've just spoke about. So I think my worry would be just trying to manage expectation of everyone. Just keep going, keep doing our best, keep trying to get better as a team, and myself trying to get better as a coach, and yeah, work as hard as possible and see where it takes us.
Brilliant to talk to you. Just going back to my very first question, are you a big shoe man yourself? Do you have you got a good collection of shoes? Do they interest you, or is that well in the family's past?
No, it's well in the family's past. I've got a couple of pair of Altanis that I wear on the touchline. It cost me. That's another bad thing about being a manager. You've got to spend a few more pounds on looking half decent on the touchline. So, but no, it's all good. I'm enjoying it, loving life down here, and long may it continue.
Keep up the great work, mate. Good to talk to you, Stephen.
Cheers, Glenn. Thanks, mate. Take it easy.
That is it for this episode. A big thank you to Stephen Schumacher and to Joby. If you've enjoyed listening, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you would like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Join us again soon for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.